The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So before lunch, we had a little discussion, and some of you talked about seeing the impulse to think, or some the drive to think, sort of drive or impulse, and how you could perhaps be a little bit independent of that impulse, of that drive, when you have this foundation of being calm, and perhaps you can let go of it and not get involved, just let it go or whatever. So from that perspective, there's maybe a less interest in being in thinking, less interested in being driven or these impulses. Whereas if you weren't a meditator, perhaps it would never occur to you that you had this choice about to be interested or not interested in the drive to think, the drive to be involved. So from the perspective of meditation, either the sitting or your broader time that you're meditating, what perspective does it give you on what you're interested in, or what you'd like to be interested in, or what wisdom do you have around interest? What perspective on this topic of I'd like to hear from some people. How is it that interest might shift with someone who's able to get settled in meditation?
To speak from past experience, as past experience, because I'm not having that experience right now. But what does happen is there are times that the thoughts will come up, and I realize they're not important, and then letting them go, there's an incredible feeling of release that comes from that, and. It's a liberating feeling, like I don't have to follow that, and I can feel that in my body. Mm-hmm. Everything will settle. Letting you know, my back all today is really hurting, but normally that will subside. So maybe I'll get it.
Mm-hmm. So one of the perspectives of meditation can give you some a lot of things you normally think are important are not so important, and then there's a great sense of relief in the release of that. Right, so it's a changing perspective on what's important comes, okay?
I noticed that there are thoughts that are connected to strong feelings, and then there are thoughts that are built on those thoughts. And then thoughts that are built on those thoughts. And so I notice that the secondary and tertiary thoughts aren't as interesting meditation. But the first thought and its connection to the sort of the quality of energy around here is interesting.
It's interesting. Yeah. Could you imagine that a state of mind where you might not be even interested in those thoughts? Or you might not be interested in gauging your feelings. Like feelings happen, but, you know, can you imagine that?
Intellectually.
Intellectually, that's good. just start.
Well, this morning, I had the experience where I was kind of down. I had like two levels, and I was like almost physically, I could tell the difference in my experience. Like I was down here, and the breathing, and that was like down here, and then I could pop up, and there was this level of thought going on, and it's like I found I could just sink below it and just kind of stay there and still kind of be aware of it going on. And then this afternoon I just went totally crazy in thinking. But
So from the perspective of what happened in the morning, what different point of view does it give you on interest, what you're interested in, and how much interest?
I'm interested in how I got to that place there. I'm not interested in the thoughts, but in fact, it's like I'm not really interested, but somehow. I get
something's interested.
Something's
interested. You're not interested, but something is interested. That's good. I think that's good. It's how it is. So, what I imagine is that someone, like maybe before meditating, before that dropping experience of being lower, it never occurred to you that there was an option around how interested you are in thoughts. You know, something like that. That's something we think. That's what goes on. And there's a whole different perspective now in how interesting or important or...
I do have that experience, and what I find is that as I go along, it's almost like I'm being teased with thoughts. Like I think, well, this is important because this is about my breath or this is about my body. And it's like almost like my mind's trying to trick me into coming, you know, going out there and grabbing on.
Well, I'm glad that you're in a position to be tricked, because most people are in a continual state of being tricked. They don't even know that they've been tricked. They're in the trick.
I go back and forth.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Hillary.
So this is mindfulness meditation.
What we're doing.
No, I mean, as opposed to the insight part, because I guess I'm not clear where the insight comes from, because I've gotten very, very calm, let go of my thoughts, but I have no insight either.
Okay.
I'm just wondering where the insight comes in. And
it comes in next.
So if I stayed for the next sitting, then I would get to the insight.
The next sitting? Oh, I don't know if I can promise that. But, you know, next in your process. Whatever, you know. But we don't know the speed in which your process is going here. But what I'm offering here today is a little bit insight, and here's insight into your interest level. What are you interested in? So from that calm perspective, do you have a different understanding or different perspective on what is interesting for your mind to do and engage in when you're calm?
No, I mean I was just able to just let go of the thought. So
yeah, and so that's great, and you're calm. And if I came and said to you, you know, you really need to start thinking about your taxes. You know, would you kind of I better start thinking about that? Or would you say, not now, please? What? Not now. Disinterest, right? So are you having some insight that you don't even know about yet about what is interesting, what is not interesting to do with your mind? From that calm perspective, are you starting to develop a disinterest in certain activities that you don't want to pick up, you don't want to get involved in?
Yeah, I guess. At least I know that there's the choice there.
What?
I realize that there's the choice.
The choice, So what I'd like to propose, that's a kind of insight, an important one, is the insight into that you have a choice. And that certain things that seemed very interesting in the past, now you're getting disinterested in. And that's a kind of insight, but maybe you're not giving yourself enough credit for that, how that operates in your mind. You're just focusing on the calm. But my guess is in that calm place, there's some way of being or not being that you differentiate between slightly now, that you value one over the other. Is that accurate?
I guess. I mean, I think that I'm not sure that the interest isn't still there. It's just I've decided to set that aside for the moment. And I guess the key is to try to stay in that place.
I don't know
if
about that.
If I choose to be in that place off the cushion, uh-huh. to be able to get there.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and maybe. But the right now I want to focus on this interest thing. Is that you've chosen not to be interested right now in certain things. And so from the perspective of what you're trying to do or where you're at, you've lost interest in it. And that takes a little bit of evaluation, some insight, some understanding about something. And so I think you have some degree of insight already. And maybe you haven't been able to identify it, you don't look at it, you don't think of it that way. Maybe you have some big idea that insight is somehow big and explosive or something, you know. So we'll talk more about it, but let me talk about what I'm going to talk about here, and then we'll see if that helps. So I saw someone over here before.
I found that there was a sense of simplicity in focusing simply on the breath. And the clutter that is the habitual living condition for me is diminishes, and there was a preconception that in the clutter there is depth and there is it's profound to keep thinking and to come up with ideas or solutions, and staying with the breath kind of made the clutter look like clutter. and there was a sense of clarity. Nothing revealing, but just clearer waters, mm-hmm. so to speak.
Great. It's like a difference between watching television forever, thinking there's a lot of depth and value and beauty in television, and then you see the Discovery Channel, wow, nature's really great and so beautiful. And then you realize, wait a minute, I can go out and into nature myself, and then it's three-dimensional, there's smells and all this, it's so much richer. So we can be fooled easily by the surface mind. So what? Oh, Kim's trying. Sue. Okay, one more, and I would like to say a few things.
So it was this afternoon, it was very great to me. A good experience is that when I counting, you know, it was a lot of shallow thoughts comes. As you said, thoughts came in. I said, oh, I don't want to do that. I go back to breathing, and then back and forth, another thoughts all the time. And I try to do the counting. So I was able to do counting 10. Within that counting, 1, 2, 3, 4, there's no thoughts. That was great experience.
Beautiful.
This simple one was, yeah, keep, you know.
Good. Keep counting.
Keep counting. Yes.
I counted my breath for years. It's what I was taught in Zen practice.
How long could you count?
For years.
I mean, 10, hundreds?
What?
High, yeah.
Well, I tried to get to 10.
Oh. And then come back to 1?
And then go back to 1.
10. Okay. So that's good way to do it,
yeah.
Right? Excellent. Thank you.
So, using the word interest and disinterest, but this is, I'm taking this as a synonym for the 13th stage of the 16 stages of breathing, and that's the Pali word is viraga. We talked about it last time, and it's usually translated as either dispassion or disenchantment. Usually dispassion, kind of where our passion, our drive, gets diminished. And now in English, sometimes the word passion has a lot of positive connotations in the last 20, 30 years in the way it didn't originally. And so we have to be a little nuanced in how we use the word. But the drive, the drivenness, the strong interest, for certain things gets diminished from the perspective of doing meditation practice. So that's the kind of what I'm trying to point to here a little bit today. And one of the places, so partly it needs to, we need to get calm or more expansive in the mind or settled or peaceful or concentrated or happy, sense of well-being. There's a variety of changes that can happen as we meditate. And those changes then give us a different perspective on what's interesting. So for example, if the safest, most contented place you know is deep in meditation, for example, then you start thinking about how, I hope they still have some of that ice cream left over they left out at lunch, because it'd be great, you know, then I'd be really content. But wait a minute, I already have the best contentment. I know ice cream is not going to provide me with contentment. I have it. And so that sense of well-being and meditation gives a different perspective on what the sources of happiness are, what the sources of well-being are. So we have this good sense of, hopefully a good sense of well-being. But the mind in deep meditation is also very still, very quiet. And from that perspective of being calm, it's easier to see the arising of things and the ceasing of things. So we see the arising of a thought, as opposed to being in the middle of a thought train. And we say, oh, or we see arising of a feeling, an emotion, or we see arising of a sound or anything, things arise. And you see it because you have some perspective now, an interest or disinterest, there's a natural tendency, almost a natural tendency, okay, not now. I'm not going to get involved in that. I'll leave it alone. And then, for example, thoughts, generally, if you don't get involved in thoughts, thoughts fade away pretty quickly. They cease. So the 15th step in the 16 stages is being aware of cessation. So it was implied is you're aware of the existence of something, the arising of something. And then it's important to notice that things come to an end. So a thought arises, for example, using thoughts as an example. Thought arises and a thought ceases. And you see the ending of it. Now, what do you think could be the value in noticing that a thought, a particular concern, has now disappeared from the mind for the time being? You know, here and now, kind of, oh. What's the advantage of seeing that, you think? The cessation. So you see impermanence, but why is that interesting? Okay, so it's true. So you see the truth, which is pretty satisfying. Anything else? How significant is it if you can just leave? It's because the mind has a way of telling you that this is the most important issue of your life. And then suddenly you see it cease and you're doing quite well without it. So what happened? So how significant can it be? Okay, thank you. Someone else. What's significant about seeing the ending of things, cessation? You don't have to get stuck in it. So you don't have to get forever. So when you see things cease, it frees you from the delusion of permanence. That I'm going to be this way forever. This is the way. I'm going to be thinking about this forever. Okay?
It also frees you from acting on the thought.
It frees you from acting on the thought. Uh-huh. So when you see it cease, then it's no longer going to push you around. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Yes? So it makes it easier in the future to continue to let go, because you're not going to be so enchanted by it, so caught by it. You realize, wait, there's another opportunity here. There's another wonderful thing if I let go of it. Okay? Not so sticky.
I think there's the emotional attachment that, you know, you see the thought go away and you have to let go of it emotionally.
Mm. So in watching the thought goes away, then the emotion that's connected to the thinking or the emotional involvement or the also fades away.
Okay. Yeah, and you also have, yeah, and you have that sense of by.
Mm-hmm. Great. Spindle, last one, then I want to say something more.
I don't know that I've ever actually been around to observe it leave. I've only noticed that it...
Okay. That's pretty good. And so what if it's not thinking that you're seeing arise and pass, but you're sitting here, say you were sitting here peaceful and calm, minding your own business, mind is content, and what comes up is an issue of self-representation. This is how I have to look to others. This is how I want others to see me. This is who I really am. I need to prove it to someone. That kind of concern, selfing, me, myself, and mine kind of concerns arise. And you see it arising. You see the arising of me, myself, or mine. So, and you see it cease. What kind of wisdom does it give you on this activity of the mind that makes things into me, myself, and mine? Around self.
That's not who I am.
That's not who I am.
I can see that when I was all wrapped up in it as being me, and that's not who I am.
So if you see something, you see that doesn't exist, then it arises, and then you see it fade away, then wait a minute, if that arises and passes, you know, I'm still here.
Something like that.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay, good. Tanya? Good. So you don't, it doesn't define. So an itch or something. So, for example, it's possible to have a knee pain or some physical pain, and it's possible to watch because you have this calm perspective base to watch. You can watch the arising of the thought that says, this is my pain. Just in, yeah. And so it comes back to something very simple, and you elaborated on it. But even to go back to this example of my pain, you can see the arising of the concept, my pain. You say, oh, that just arose now. Something was created in the moment, and I don't have to be so interested in that. I can just let go of my the thought of my pain. If you're going to start analyzing, well, is it someone else's pain? No, it has to be mine. And you know what are these Buddhists talking about? You know. Then you're lost, right? But you can watch the activity of the mind, a certain activity of the mind that constructs, that makes the concept my pain. And it's an innocent enough concept. It's not like your neighbor's pain. So it's your pain. But still, it's a concept that's creating. Your mind is creating. And then it's possible to let go of that concept, have that concept cease. And you realize, oh, the concept my pain, the concept is impermanent. And it's possible to see sometimes, for example, that whenever I call it my pain, it hurts more. And when it's just the pain, or just you just leave it as it is, and then it doesn't hurt as much. Right, so you don't take it personally. If taken personally as an activity of the mind, then this is you're not that activity of the mind, you're not interested in that activity. And so you get disenchanted, you get dispassionate toward the activity of making this into me. Now, when you go to the doctor, and you don't say, "Oh, some knee in the universe is," you know, it hurts. You know, and I don't know who's me, because I'm taking it also in person. Like, I don't do that mental, like, I don't do that mental activity of selfing, yeah. You know, you spare the doctor. You say, you know, it's my knee. That's a useful concept in the doctor's office, certain areas. But so it's a useful concept. But when you're sitting in meditation, you see that there's some choice to be had, whether you kind of get involved in this thinking, oh, my this, my that. And there's a whole range of me, myself, and mine that goes on. I'm a good meditator. I'm a bad meditator. Oh, you know, I can't do this. I can't do this today. You know, so all these thoughts. And we tend to believe these, and it's almost like they're the true, not just representation of nature, but they are nature, these thoughts that we tell ourselves. But when you're calm and settled, you can see the arising of these things. Oh, it's just it's a construction that arises in the moment, and I cannot be engaged in it. I cannot be interested in it. I cannot be driven by it. I can just kind of leave it alone and come back to the settled place. And then I can see the seizing of this. And to see the seizing of the sense of self, the idea of self, is very powerful. You see the impermanence of it. You see that you don't exist. You don't depend on it. You see there's a possibility of happiness and well-being and variety of good things free of it. You see it as a construct. It gives you a lot of power, a lot of choice, a lot of something. So the sutta goes, breathing in, one is mindful of cessation. Breathing out, one is mindful of cessation. One sees the passing of things. Now, as practice, mindfulness gets deeper and stronger. At some point, it isn't just, you know, a thought arises and a minute later it goes away or something. But everything that you turn your attention towards is seen as a rising and passing phenomena. You see rising and passing and rising and passing. And when you see it arising and passing in that way, it's also possible to see the way in which we're interested in it, engaged in it, you know, clinging to it or resisting it or something. And we see that the resistance, the clinging, the engagement, the interest is a separate thing from what's arising and passing. And because it's separate, we might feel, oh, I don't have to be this way. I can leave what's arising and passing alone. I don't have to get engaged in it. And because of being engaged in it is to get myself agitated, aroused. And I have this good, secure place that I'm in. Also, when you see the arising and passing of things this way, you realize that things are, this is again deep meditation, that in the arising and passing of things, there's nothing there that it's possible to cling to. And actually, what we cling to is we cling to an idea of what's there, not what's really there. Clinging is almost always to ideas, oddly enough, not to real things. Now, you're at the edge of the Empire State Building, you know, hold on to the railing, please. But we cling to ideas, concepts. And when we're actually in deep touch with how things actually arise and pass, free of concepts, then we realize that actually there's nothing there that I can cling to. So, for example, if you see the arising of the thought, my pain, and you see that as soon as it arisen, it fades away. That's its nature. Just rises. Then you say, oh, I'm going to grab, next time it comes up, I'm going to grab it and hold on to my pain, the idea, concept of my pain. And you go to that thought, and by the time you get there, it's gone. Wow, I can't hold on to that. But it gets even more interesting because the pain itself arises and passes. I'm going to resist the pain. And you look, you're kind of really there, it's already gone. Isn't that interesting? So seeing the rising and passing of things is a very is part of the insight, deep insight that comes with strong vipassana practice. Really seeing the rising and passing, but seeing the passing as the cessation of all these things goes on. Then one of the powerful things that can happen at some point, you realize that it's not really in your interest to cling to any of that stuff. And so even though it's gone for the moment, gone for the day or something, at some point, there's a deep, deep feeling, I think I'm just going to relinquish, give up, abandon the underlying tendency to be interested in this activity. So it isn't just simply kind of giving it up now, here and now, but the underlying tendency that gets you interested in that, whatever it might be. The underlying greed, underlying clinging that might be there. So the 16th stage, the last stage of these 16, is breathing in, one relinquishes. Breathing out, one knows relinquishment. One relinquishes, one releases. So it isn't just simply, so after cessation, after seeing the rising and passing of things, the rising and cessation of things very clearly, at some point the mind turns itself around, or the mind changes itself at what in Buddhism we call the root of the mind, where the mind itself relinquishes some tendency, some impulse to want to cling to all kinds of things. And when that's done in a very thorough, or very deep-seated way, then in Buddhism we call it the experience of liberation. This experience of liberation, let go. And one of the things, one of the deep things to let go of, to relinquish, is this whole kind of game of self-concept, self-representation, self-presentation. The whole game there, this is who I am, self-definition, this is who I really am, I'm going to kind of, you know, hold on to this or build it up or whatever I'm going to do. And the underlying, we relinquish the motivation, the impulse to be interested in that, to want that. It's not necessarily something, a relinquishment that we choose, but rather something that happens in the mind. So partly it can be a choice, but partly sometimes it's a transformation, a turning of the mind. So when the mind is settled enough, can become dispassionate enough, when it sees its impermanence strongly enough, becomes dispassionate enough, has had enough experience with the cessation of things, then at some point, the mind itself, some underlying deep impulse in the mind, relaxes, lets go, frees itself. And that some of these deeper impulses then don't surface, don't come up again. Some of them get very weak first before they go away. So that's the 16 stages, 16th stage, the stage of relinquishment. And relinquishment, the word, Pali word for relinquishment is kind of an odd word. But it also has the meaning of, can apparently have the meaning of to give something back. And so there's this one Theravada teacher, Buddhadasa, who translated it as giving back, and giving back to nature. So rather than appropriating things for yourself, you return things to nature the way they are. And in fact, the part of the word can mean nature also. So you return to, actually, pati nisaga can also mean, kind of, if you take it, it's not too literal, but it kind of works. So return to nature. So I don't think the Buddha would go along with this too much, but you do this wordplay on this, then the final relinquishment allows everything to return to its nature. We return to nature. Things become their nature. And I think that's kind of inspiring, kind of beautiful. In case you thought relinquishment was a form of a severe deprivation. It's really beautiful. You know, everything returns to its nature. And so those are the 16 stages. And today we skipped over a whole bunch of them, for those of you who might be new to this. But, you know, we've been doing it over the last year. Yes?
So, is the relinquishment of stopping considered the primary aspect of the 16 stages?
No. Just an example. There's very little commentary about these 16 stages. So most teachers have to kind of interpret it to some degree, what it means. And in the experience of awakening, the first thing that tends to go is the belief in the concept of a self. It doesn't mean the person still doesn't have some conceit or some building up around self a little going on, but they no longer believe in it. So even if you don't believe in it, there still might be some engagement in it. But that belief is no longer there.
I'm really grateful that you just told us, Gil, about this arising from a very, very, very calm state, and the mind just kind of does it itself rather than, well, what I'm understanding right now is that rather than our doing this relinquishing, it's something that just happens if we're, well, there are a lot of things to fill in there, but that seems so, it's something I'm really wanting to learn, because I have a tendency to just cling to this idea of relinquishment and then blame myself because I'm not, see, here I should know better. In other words, something arises and I get all caught up in it, and then there's an extra arrow of blame, you know, that, well, you have the power to not choose this, and here you chose it again. but all of that is just stuff to watch, right?
It's stuff to watch, and I think the practice in some ways is very forgiving of us, because you can, hopefully, as the mindfulness gets stronger, you can see the arising of self-criticism.
Right, yeah.
Oh, look, that arises. I don't have to pick that up. Or you can see, even before that, because before that there might be some sense of, I'm responsible. And you can see the arising of, I'm responsible.
Yeah.
Oh, that's just an activity of the mind. That just arose, that concept. And I don't have to pick that up. Thank you.
Yeah.
So that way it's forgiving, because you can have this concept of being self-critical. So, oh, I'll just let go of it. And then you're forgiven. Or not exactly, but then it's not an issue anymore.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Just a quick question. What was the word for returning to nature?
It's pati nisaga. Pati nisaga. And pati can mean return, back, going back. Can. It's a prefix. It means a variety of things. And nisaga can apparently sometimes mean nature. The ancient Buddhist teachers were very creative with etymology. And they would use etymology kind of to make all kinds of teachings. So it's possible that the nisaga kind of means nature, but in this compound, it comes from a different root. So it really means, and the root for in this compound, it comes from the root to cling. And then and the ni part of nisaga means giving up or without clinging, giving up clinging. So it's probably closer to relinquishment than returning to nature. So it's kind of like a pun, maybe, or there's two different meanings. So, but anyway, it's what's less controversial is that the word patanisaga can also mean a kind of apparently sometimes it means to give something. So not just simply giving up, but also giving. And that's also very nice, that enlightenment is a giving, it's an act of generosity.
I was thinking that when you were saying that patinisaga talks about relinquishment, but also going back to nature, or back to nature, I think of, you know, the word dharma, which represents nature, and so it's almost like becoming dharma. I mean, is that kind of a play on?
It could be, okay. I mean, the person, who the Buddhist teacher who likes this idea of translating Patanisaga as giving back is Buddhadasa. And Buddhadasa loves to translate Dharma as nature. And it's all, you know, coming back, going back to nature worked very well for him. So yes, it's allowable. Yes, Sergio.
I find it much more challenging to see my thought in the process of arising. It's easy for me to notice it when it's there.
Yeah.
And then I can easily say, all right, I'm not interested in this now. But is there any practices, recommendation on how you could catch it before even starting to enter my mind?
Well, I think that any practice that gets your mind really still and quiet, calm, it was helpful for this. Also, strengthening the mindfulness, the alertness. So you're much more mindful and alert, ready to catch something. So you're right there, kind of in the present moment. You're like, maybe it's not the best analogy, but it's kind of like a cat at the mouse door. You know, you're ready to notice anything that happens. So you're so mindfulness is so strong, it's right there. So at times, mindfulness can become that strong, and they can see it. In daily life, I think it's hard to do it that way. But in strong meditation, sometimes. And what's interesting is in strong meditation, deep meditation, it's possible to feel or to see or sense the arising of the impulse to think. And some people report that it's kind of like they feel like there's a bubble arising in their mind, like their mind is like a pond or a body of water, and this bubble is starting to form to come free from that. So you feel this pressure, this movement, this impulse to think. And then you let go of it. The person lets go of that impulse. And so the impulse to think falls away. And the person will never know what they were going to think. So in other words, the impulse to think can come to consciousness before the content of the thought arises. And this is also very interesting in terms of how much control and responsibility we have for what we think. When you can start forming a thought offline, you know, in this subconscious, you know, it forms someplace back there, and then it begins to surface, but you snip it before it bursts. And then, you know, who knows? It might have been the solution for your life. And then there it went. So anyway, so the practice you're doing is the answer. Just keep doing your mindfulness, keep developing concentration, and in time. And some of the things I'm talking about today, remember, we're talking about these 16 stages, and most of you, you know, all of you just kind of walked off the street this morning. So, you know, this is, these 16 stages are meant to be, you know, fairly well-developed meditation. I think most people, to really do it well, this is what happens on retreats. It is not something you kind of walk off the street and expect to kind of make it work. And what I tried to do here in this series and today is to try, through the guided meditation, is try to give you enough calm or enough perspective, enough to at least have some appreciation of what goes on, what's possible. I didn't expect you all to sit here and end of the day just relinquish it all, and you know, it would be nice. but I think that having some almost visceral sense of what's possible here is very helpful, and will support you. Kind of opens the door, opens the channels. So when you do sit, that it's easier to kind of go through those doors. Yes.
At the end of the guided meditation, when you said to think about, what's happening with the thought process, I can't remember exactly how you phrased it, but I remember that you had the word in there, thinking, and it was really interesting because when I was meditating and I heard that, it was like, I didn't have an inclination to want to think about that. And so it was really interesting to just kind of go, oh. And then I just kind of let it go instead of...
Yeah, I was afraid of that.
Going into instead
or,
of thinking
I thought,
about it.
I thought it was possible that, you know, here you were somewhat calm and settled, and I was introducing to you something to kind of think about. And so some of you, I thought, would just get confused, you know. What? I'm supposed to think, how am I supposed to figure this one out? Think about this, you know, but then I'm caught in thinking. But I was hoping you would find your way and just kind of keep it calm. And sometimes if you just, sometimes just dropping a question into meditation, it gets processed kind of, again, offline or off stage or some more intuitive way than actually thinking it out logically. So. Yeah.
What you describe on the 16th step about the mind itself actually, it kind of turns around and it stops doing this. It reminds me of what I heard Eugene Cash talking about at New Year's about falling away. And one of the things I remember him saying that helps me with this is the idea of continually setting up the conditions for this to happen. So even if we're not in retreat, which we can't be all the time, it's a consciousness about always, you know, is this really important to think about? Is this really important to follow? So a mindset all the time and a way of living that supports that. And it starts to happen slowly.
Right. Beautiful. Yeah. I think we, you know, and also, you know, we take whatever steps along the path that we can. And it might be very small steps we take, but all the steps add up over time. And so you don't have to feel bad about taking small steps, but you do it all, and do it all the time. Bring this to daily life, and daily life, do whatever you can. And then with time, it'll all mature.
When you asked the question about the comment about the thinking process, I used the word energy, and what I meant was tenseness. And I feeling tense. I feel myself, it's slightly sometimes, but tenseness, and which is not a good feeling. And so I can breathe into it and kind of relax, and it's carried over, I'm finding, into, you know, just everyday life. When I feel myself tightening up, it's because there's a thought scenario going on that is meaningless. It usually is applying to me, myself, or mine. And that is helping me to let go a little bit more.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And the more relaxed the body becomes, the more that offers a vantage point to notice when we get tense. If you're always going around tense, then that's business as normal. But if you had more relaxed you are, and more relaxed, the more you have a tendency to see the deep workings of the mind. So being relaxed is very helpful for this. The tension tends to, if you're caught in the tension, it tends to mask so much, hide so much what's going on. Good. So we're finishing, for those of you who did the whole year, now this is the end. end of the year. You know, in Tibetan Buddhism, they have a custom of going on retreats with a teacher. And the teacher basically teaches most of the time. And some Tibetan retreats, they don't even have silence during the retreat. And they just talk and hang out the whole time. And they get all this download of teachings. And then the expectation is for the next year you go off to the cave by yourself and practice it. So I hope you all have your cave. And go off and practice and those of you who like doing these Friday Dharma practice days, you have until October to be in your cave. And then in October we'll start the next year's cycle. And we'll do Dharma practice series next year, and next year we're going to do the five hindrances. And so for those of you who are, there's maybe a couple of you who are struggling in meditation. You know, this is meant for you. No, so, you know, this is kind of getting down to some of the, as I like to say, I think working with the hindrances is really half of the path. The hindrances aren't to be seen as hindrances, as being unfortunate visitors. The hindrance, learning how to be wise and skillful with the hindrances is a big part of what meditation practice is about. And if you felt some of this, like today, is too idealistic, too lofty, too much, you know, getting really calm and peaceful, and then you have this perspective, and some of you are just rolling your eyes probably at this kind of idea. So next year, we'll talk about just really good stuff, like just desire, greed, lust, clinging, craving, you know, such things. Is that good? Probably same thing, yeah. So I think it's in October. And anything we need to do to, you know, realizing it's coming to the end of the year, any bigger questions about any of this that over the year that you feel you want to ask in order to feel complete for the year?
I don't have anything to ask, but I do want to express my gratitude and the fact that we're so fortunate to have a year-long program such as this or many of the other ones that you've done. And it's a wonderful opportunity.
Okay, thank you. It's very nice. And it's also, I also very much appreciate those of you who come, keep coming back, and your engagement, your sincerity, and the efforts you're making, and your consideration, how you're applying it in your life and stuff. It's really great. It's very rewarding to me to teach this way. So I appreciate you all very much. Yes, go here. Another one.
Thank you. I don't have a question. I have a comment that you said a few weeks ago or a few times ago that I've like to have something that I take away from a years-long experience. And the thing that this time has encapsulated this time for me is your instruction to take everything into the breath.
Beautiful. Good. Thank you. That makes me happy. Carol.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I have a small study group in South Bay, and I'm thinking 4 months is a very long time until this series starts up again. Any suggestions for perhaps if we keep our study group going, how we might, go about it? But
I mean, kind of continuing this momentum in this topic, kind of?
Yeah. Any topic that's relevant. Topic.
And if you want to continue this, you might Buddhadasa's book on the 16 stages. Okay. I forget exactly the title right now, but Mindfulness of Breathing is some of that book I think is really nice. Some of it I don't care so much for, but some of it I think is really nice. And so that's one way is to kind of dip into that book, and it's a way of continuing with this kind of topic.